like timer. Okay. Let's get back into our discussion of class actions. Here I put up the general requirements again. We've got 23A, which are prerequisites of numerosity, commonality, typicality, and adequacy of representation. After you get over that hurdle, then you have to select which class you're actually in, and you're going to fit one of these. Now, the reality is you might have an argument for multiple ones, but we do pick a selection of what kind of class you're going to be, and it makes a difference, especially if you're in the damaging class versus the other two, which we call mandatory classes, and we'll see that today a bit. All right, we talked about Huebler, and I'd like to refresh your recollection about that and get back into our discussion of this case. We're then going to turn to Walmart, where we're going to talk a little bit about what's before the Supreme Court right now. If you went to the little women's law debate, you might have heard a little bit about it. I've seen this on the news. What I want you to really use it as a way to review what we know about class actions, talk about some of the struggles with class actions, and to the extent that we don't finish that, we'll do that in our next class as well. I remember Huebler, these are the people who formed a plaintiff's class of all GM dealers located in Indiana. They claimed that GM unlawfully and unilaterally took 1% of the MSRP on all new sales cars, new cars, for national advertisements. And that prior to this, they believed they had use of the MSRP on their own. So they were seeking, they were seeking a declaratory judgment that the marketing funds in question actually belonged to them and not to, we're just going to do regular here. Hold on 1 second. And not to the national chain. And so they were asking for not only the declaratory judgment that these are really ours, but also asking for treble damages for the conversion of all the assets and for attorney's fees. And as a result, we're trying to get a class action out of it. Now, we went through the prerequisites already and determined that the court found, in fact, that they met the prerequisites. And where we left off was talking about what type of class they fit in. I had a few questions after class about the types of classes, so I wanted to make sure that we understood why they didn't fit the first part, which is where we were. All right, here we go. CPS, second crazy, so we're just going to do it this way. That's just my summary of what I told you. Here we go. Okay. So here's what I gave you, like sort of like the graphic way to look at the types of classes. All right, the two we know they're not, which come out of the prejudice standard, incompatible standards for the class. There's prejudice to the person who's outside the class, the defendant, as individual suits, if we don't become a class, might create incompatible standards. And we said that's looking at GM in this case and asking, are they going to do something that might be incompatible if they have multiple suits by individuals? And we know that when the issue is you have to pay me damages, that I can consistently do that. I may not want to consistently pay out to different people, but the reality is that's not something that's impossible or incompatible for me to do. Compare that to, like, our coin collection. You know, it's less people, it's not a class, but it's the same idea. If you get one court ordering, you should give it to this person. Another court ordering, you should give it to that person. You physically can't do that. The example that we had in the book was with respect to issuance of the city bonds and whether or not the city could have two inconsistent standards of yes, continue to issue and honor your bonds, or no, they're unconstitutional. Right? The limited fund class, the couple questions I got, pertain to whether or not you could do this if the person was going bankrupt. And I told you that's not really what this is. Okay, this is generally where you actually have a defined limited source of funds, like a pool of assets. So where this often happens is when you've had statutorily created funds out of which you're going to pay things out. So the nuclear damage fallout has a cap on it. At a certain point, you know, that's all you're ever going to have to pay out if you have a nuclear fallout. All right. September 11th had a fund that was limited in the sense that at a certain point, the airlines and other industries that might otherwise be liable for negligence in their actions that gave rise to all the deaths on September 11th and all the property damage are going to have a cap. You know, there's lots of those kinds of things. So what's the problem with bankruptcy? Well, oftentimes it's not a true set limited cap. And so the Supreme Court in like 1999 in a case called Ortiz versus Fiber Board said for a group that was trying to say this company's going into bankruptcy, they're going to have limited assets,
our claims are going to go exceeding that. We should be able to classify as a limited fund. Court said just this assertion and the agreement that your assets are going to be lower than what the outside claims are going to be is not enough. It has to be like a true, defined, and provable limited amount of assets. Because bankruptcy, a lot of people kind of shift things around sometimes, you know, at least the fear of impending bankruptcy, and they don't want people to be able to say, we're just going to agree I've got limited assets so that you can sue me as a class. What we're worried about there oftentimes are the sweetheart deals where the defendants are actually kind of, you know, chumming up with the first plaintiff's class to then bind other people because they know that that class will get a better result and all these other people then can't sue if they were bound by the first lawsuit. Okay. Here we don't have a limited source of funds. GM obviously has a limited source of funds, but it's not like a cap, like a set pool where the people who are going to be suing, their claims are likely to exceed it. Think about the policy behind this one if you have problems with this one, because this is the one I got lots of questions on. The policy here is we have a set amount of money, and we know people, if they came and sued us individually, the sum total would be over that set amount of money. So we bring you together as a class. That way people get an equitable distribution, as opposed to you sued first and you got to the pot first, so you got more money. And the guy who sues last, even though his claims might be valid and even more significant than the first people to the pool, aren't going to find a well dry. That's the idea. Okay? So are there any more questions on that one at all? Is that about like four or five at your class? So I want to make sure that we understand that. Yeah.
So these statutes, I mean, like with 9/11, before that happened, there wasn't a statute that says in the case of a disaster like this, right? I mean, so these statutes, are they already in place before something happens, or are they usually enacted after?
It depends. Okay. So oftentimes an event will trigger that. So the nuclear kind of event was, or Three Mile Island really triggered those kinds of things. But September 11th was a specific source for it. It's literally called the September 11th Fund. So. But they're all primarily, this is driven by statute. That's not the only way you can find it, but that's primarily what you'll see. The idea is, the key aspect you're looking at is, do you have a definitive and provable set number, a set pool of assets, not a I think we're going to run out situation, but a true set pool of assets, and that you know the claims are likely to exceed it. Yeah.
So if a drug company says we've set aside $500 million for litigation?
No, because they can't be like, no, because they can't say, hey, this is all I'm ever going to pay you.
Yeah.
No. It's more of, we have agreed, like the ones that Congress does, they set caps so that people don't bankrupt organizations that we otherwise want them to continue. So if you think about it, September 11th, those individuals, we don't want the airlines to go out of business, or others who are also involved in that, nuclear power plants, we want to have them, we think they're good use of energy, for electricity, but we don't want to leave people without compensation, but we have like balance there, so we give enough to give what we think is going to be sufficient compensation. We regulate that industry quite significantly to make sure that they're acting safe, so we hopefully avoid that, but if we do, we don't want the whole entire industry to decide it's not worth it. It's big money things that you typically see these things, so like nuclear operations. Like if we goof this up, it's a big, big problem. All right, so it's not like the company. And you can't set it yourself, which is kind of what they were trying to do when they argued in the Ortiz case through bankruptcy. Look, we can tell you this is all the assets we have left. That's not what the court typically allows you to do. I'm not saying it can never be, because the court actually left a small door open, but you have to have concrete evidence as to the limited nature of the funds available. Okay. Anything else on that one? All right, so then let's talk about the rest of them with respect to the Huebler case. The next one we have is an injunctive relief class. All right, so for an injunctive relief class, the rule tells us the party opposing the class has acted or refused to act on grounds apply generally to the class so that final injunctive relief or corresponding declaratory relief is appropriate respecting the class as a whole. All right, so let's. I just wanted to talk to you about this one. What kind of cases do we typically see, Mr. Bokesh? What kind of cases do we typically see when it comes to these kinds of things? I'm sorry. What? Okay. Well, can we just kind of think about what the rule says? I'll get to the ones that are in the book, but let's just kind of think about what this might be. What are they trying to get at? What are they trying to get at here? I'm sorry? Okay.
Go back to my seating chart.
All right, we'll get to the next class.
How about Mr. Burns? Why don't you help us out? What kind of situation is the rule contemplating here?
When a group of citizens come from the state of dumping waste products in your neighborhood, then they seek to stop
them. Okay, so the book gives us an example of someone polluting an area, and the injunction is to stop the pollution. All right, how does that kind of situation, like let's stop the polluter, where the people that live around the polluter fit this particular kind of rule? Like, what's the gist of the rule? Yeah, what are we trying to get at here?
Where they're seeking more of a, I don't want to use the exact language for the rule, but...
I do. It's okay. It's all right. Go ahead. Try and put... So in other words, pick out the operative pieces. That's a very good exercise.
In injunctive relief, asking the party to cease from doing whatever activity they're doing.
Okay.
So more monetary damages really wouldn't suffice as they're dumping toxic waste.
Okay, would we want potentially injunctive relief in that kind of a case?
Absolutely.
Yeah, we might. And so we're going to see, like in Hubler, where we ask for injunctive relief, there might be a problem in that we might be also asking for damages, and we have to kind of figure out which one's the best fit. But in this kind of a situation, if we haven't had a lot of damages yet, but we're really trying to cease what they're about to do, then injunctive relief might be more appropriate. Now, could I, as one property owner, sue that dumper by myself for injunctive relief, or do I need everybody suing? Could I? Yes, you could, because it's a invasion of my property. I could sue under property principles. It's a tort, a nuisance. Have you learned that yet? I could sue under that. In fact, I'd probably bring multiple claims. There's probably even a federal claim with respect to environmental hazards and state claims, which regulate this kind of activity. And I would ask, I'd like to have this enjoined so that you don't do this to my property. So why do we ask? Why do we permit a class action if you could, in fact, do this on your own? Yeah.
Is it more powerful?
Okay, maybe it's more powerful because we might be able to bring our assets together to litigate this. Mm-hmm.
If a whole neighborhood is affected by the same activity, it's probably better for them all to bring it at the same time instead of overflowing the courts with 30 different claims by the same people that are complaining about the same activity.
Okay, so let's talk about what the tension is, because it is a situation where it makes more economic, like judicial economic sense. Some of it might be strategy ourselves, that all together we can get our assets together to go against this other company, where me as an individual property owner against a large company, that might not be a fair fight. All of us as a neighborhood against the company, more fair, right? But the other aspect that you're raising is one of judicial resources. Now, is it really going to be a flood of litigation? Potentially. But what's the likelihood to happen? Are you going to be resolving the same issues in each case? Or do you think there's going to be different issues in each case? Let's assume it's nuisance, and some of you nodded your head as to I recognize that word. All right, or you can just think of a basic trespass on your property if that feels more comfortable. I'll tell you the gist of it is all relatively the same. Hint, hint, for your other classes. But yes, okay, so what kind of issues would be similar in our case as to our neighborhood?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same general problem because they're being bothered or, you know, their land's being polluted, but I think it could be, you could draw some differences where, homes that are closer to the plant or whatever are probably getting it more than ones that are farther away, so.
If we're seeking injunctive relief, does it matter that some homes are going to be more excited about the injunction than others?
Do you think, anybody? I don't think so. Where would it make a difference to the people if there was differences amongst the homeowners of the amount of pollution? Yeah.
If you're seeking monetary damage or compensation.
Yeah, and that's kind of the differences in these cases. So sometimes in a case, the primary crux of it is injunctive. We really want them to stop the pollution.
We may have something ancillary that's damage-related, but we think that the class action itself is more injunctive because it's all really about let's call this as pollution. It's in violation of state law, federal law. It's a tort. It's a property action. That's the primary thing we want.
if it really becomes that we've had lots of damages, and that's really what we're seeking, we want lots of relief, it becomes a trickier thing and less likely to be an injunctive. All right, so the typical cases are where you're really focusing on the activity that you'd like ceased. That's really what it's about. That's what the people really want at the end of the day. That's the reason we've joined together. And as to each homeowner, the dumping is the same activity. There's no really unique issue. It's still wrong, even if they dumped pounds and pounds of waste on my property or little bitty amounts of waste on my property. It's still wrong for the same reasons and still likely to get the same injunctive relief. So our issues are not different enough that making us all come and sue the company individually would make sense. In fact, it makes more sense that we just do this in one action. Okay? Is this met in Hubler? Is this met in Huber? What do you think?
I'd say that it's kind of met, except for they're not sure if predominantly they're searching and kind of seeking damages, so they're going to kind of wait to figure out if damages are more appropriate.
Okay, good. So let's flesh that out. Did they seek injunctive relief?
Yeah, I think generally all of the dealers would like them to stop taking this percentage.
Yeah, so one argument they get is we're an injunctive lawsuit because we say don't take the 1%. Let us keep it locally as opposed to making it go nationally. But the court here kind of looks past that one allegation and asks, is that really what this lawsuit is about? And you ask some of the questions, you some of the language. They ask, is that the predominant thing they're seeking? The other, I think, good language in there is that the crux of the action? You know, what really is at the heart of the lawsuit? And here, they think it's a close call. What do they think? Do they think it's met here or not? Would they classify this class?
No.
Ultimately, no. They say in the end, it's not really the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter is what kind of relief?
Damages.
And so we're going to look and see if we qualify as a damages class action. There's a good quote by Judge Easterbrook from the Seventh Circuit on page 574. Indiana is within the Seventh Circuit. Easterbrook sits in Chicago. And basically, he tells us that you don't have to certify under the very first matching subsection you come to. So it's not like, oh, we see injunctive relief pled here. Automatically, we're an injunctive lawsuit. Really, he says you need to look to the most appropriate and gives us a tip. When there's a lot of money at issue, you're more likely going to be certified as a B3, not a B2. Okay. Will claiming any money damages automatically defeat an injunctive lawsuit or certification? No, it's not automatic. It's just what really is this dispute about if we were to characterize it at the heart of what they're seeking. If really what they're wanting is damages, then it should be a damages action. So why do you think they thought this one was wanting damages?
Maybe they were unsure whether or not certain individual dealers might claim.
Okay, so there might be an issue about like differences amongst our class, and we'll get to that in a moment because it's some of the challenges with this particular lawsuit that they raise. But there's why would you say it's primarily a damage suit and not primarily injunctive? What do you think they really want?
They want that back money back.
They want that money back. And how can you tell? What kind of damages were they asking for? Do you remember? They weren't just asking for
treble damage.
They're asking them for treble damages, which means take my damages and multiply it by 3. And that's what I get back, okay? Some statutes permit you to do that, treble damages. You also get interest on your judgments, and they're also seeking under the statute, in addition to treble damages, everything you owe me times 3, plus what else do they want in the form of money? Attorney's fees, okay? So when you're pleading those kinds of things, give us everything you've taken in conversion throughout the years that you've seized this 1%, then multiply by 3 and pay my counsel everything, it's pretty hard to say, I really want to enjoin them taking it. Do they really want to enjoin them taking it in the future? You betcha. Will that likely happen even when you get a damages action? Yes. Because it's going to be definitively determined that was in fact a wrong under the contractual relationship they had with GM. All right? So what they're really seeking is damages. Can you sense why this one's so substantial now? It's not just 1%. 1% of all the new car sales in the entire state of Indiana times 3 for the entire amount of time they've been taking it. All right, plus our attorney's fees. All right, so let's look at damages class and see whether they fit that.
Here, the rule tells us that the court finds the questions of law or fact common to the class members, whether they predominate over questions affecting only individual members, and that a class action is superior to other available forms for fairly and efficiently adjudicating the controversy. I'll tell you, this is the most controversial aspect of class actions. It's the one that we're going to see coming up a little bit in Walmart. It's the one that most people think about when they think of class actions. It's created the most kind of litigation about reform with respect to class actions and what defendants really complain about with respect to class actions. That you get people who want money damage and that they can go together and basically defeat you because they're a huge group as opposed to individuals. Yes?
If you get certified as a damage class and you get a judgment, does that mean that all the money has to be divided between all the plaintiffs no matter what? Like,
no.
This number divided by 200?
Okay. No, it's not a pro rata division. We'll talk about it in a moment with settlements, because often these settle as opposed to actually getting a judgment. But you get the money based upon the damages that you're able to assert. And so sometimes with these class actions, because the actual damage itself will be different, the settlement has to be appropriate based upon the nature of the damage that you had. So, you know, if you were more seriously injured, you're more likely to get a bigger piece of the settlement than if you had less injuries, and you have to bring forth your evidence. We generally put someone in charge of the management of a settlement of a class action. It's not just an easy little thing like, great, we settled, let's go home. It's a long process, and we'll talk about that in just a minute, but no. Okay, so this basically has two factors. Let's work on dividing it up. What are our two factors here? Ms. Senger, what do you think? If you were to look at this rule and break it into two elements, what do you have to show? Predominance is the word we use, but what do they mean? Because, like, predominance means, like, in, it's like sort of saying, like, very much, you know?
Like, all the places have, like, a similar effect.
It's not like that. That word, when you talk about whether they're similar, that's more something we use in the word for typicality. Predominance is kind of being a different thing, although in the same kind of vein of reasoning. What are we looking at? Like, predominance almost is like, or this predominates. It begs the this part, right? It's a word that's a modifier. So we need to figure out what it's modifying. What is predominating?
The questions.
The questions of the class, whether they be legal or factual. Okay? So either legal or factual questions that we identify. Remember we went through prerequisites and said you had to have common questions of law or fact as one of the second prerequisites? Now what we're saying is look at those. Do they predominate in this lawsuit? Or are they just sort of one of the things, and there's lots of individual disputes we'll have to work out, okay? In this case, we're going to have some questions that are not the same, okay? Like every dealer didn't pay the same amount because they had different car sales, right? Not everybody contributed in the same amount. If you had a greater car sales, you ended up paying more. If you had more by which you took 1% away. The other difference, potentially, is the fact that the GM said they all had slightly different agreements. That's what they're arguing. The dealers say, no, we didn't. You kind of dealt with us like all dealers in Indiana. But there isn't like a standard form contract in this particular situation, which would have made it even easier. But that's the first part. Predominance, what else?
Superiority.
Okay, and again, that's a nice modifier. What's superior? Class action is superior. So the words we use are predominance and superiority, but they mean predominance of common questions of law or fact over, they predominate over the individual questions of law or fact of the parties and the members. And superiority, meaning our class action is superior to any other methods of resolution. All right, so you can see we're putting more like hurdles, more hoops to go through to get to certification of a damages class, and that's intentional. Because this class is the least connected class. They have the least in common. The injunctive class, we all want the polluter to stop. The people who got issued city bonds, we all want to have the same results on what the bond really is. The people coming to the limited fund, we all have the same interest because we're all trying to get something out of the same pot. People in these kinds of cases have their own injury. And so they don't quite have the same situation as everybody else who is also injured. Think of a mass accident, like a mass transit accident.
I know, it's a delightful thought to think about. But some of us will die, right, in the massive the accident. We'll have wrongful death suits, which will try and value what our life was worth, our assets are worth at that time, at our death, and whatever our support was to people who we were supporting either through our estate potentially or people who are dependents on us. That's going to be a large number. Other people will have serious illness. They may not continue to work, but they'll survive. They're going to have less attributed to their injuries. Other people will have minor injuries. They happen to sit way far down the train. They got bumped around. They missed 2 weeks of work, but that's it. All right. Do we all have common questions of law or fact? In common. I sue the train. You sue the train. The relatives of the deceased members sue the train. Do we have common questions of law or fact? Yeah, like, what did they do that was negligent? It's common. Was it the cause of our injuries? It's common. What's the big difference? What is it worth to each of us? All right, so because of that, because when you get damages, they're associated with an individual injury, whether that be to your property or to your person. And so the reality is you have less connection. So we want to make sure that those common questions predominate. Now, so as far as Hubler goes, did they have a common question of law or fact, and was it predominant?
I just have a question. So when yes. you have that rate of huge damages, that when 23C5 comes in, you give, like, different people different classes to be a part of? Like, in the Walmart case, you have women that were, like, in higher authority versus, like, women that have, like, a seasonal job.
Oh, wait. It's not just because you have different numbers and damages.
Right.
It's the Walmart people are differently situated than someone who would be, like, in a mass accident. Because they actually have different reasons also for the motivation of the employer as to them and the conduct as to them. So you might need a different class because you actually have more than just your injury. Yeah.
Okay.
You have other things, like, were they just, like, for, we'll get to it in a minute, but.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll get to it. Hang on. All right, so predominance, common questions of law or fact. Let's stick with Hubler for the moment. What's our common question of law or fact? Ms. Stinger, want to continue for me here? What's the common question of law or fact? Right. And the question is, was that lawful by GM, or was it in violation of our contracts? Is that a predominant question in the case, or is it sort of like one of the things that we might discuss, but it's not the key crux of the case? What do you think? Yeah, the whole dispute really hinges on that. Now, GM tries to argue that to get to that question, you actually have to look at a bunch of different documents. What were my communications with dealer Fred and dealer Dan? But the reality is, as the class has it now, they've suggested that the communications were not really different amongst the dealers, even if they might have come in a different form. That they were all the same agreements, and so we can look at that. You should note, though, the court's kind of hesitant and says, look, at any point in time, we decide that, in fact, these dealers were given a different kind of assertion, a different kind of level of prompts than you were. We can split this and decertify the class even if we have to. The problem sometimes you have, like in a contract dispute like this, it's really one of coercion. And coercion requires you to show, like, falseness, the intentional falsehood of your statement, and then some reliance. And reliance is individual, right? So the court kind of leaves that open, but says for now, the way they've cast it, we think it's sufficient to say there is a predominance of this question, whether or not GM unlawfully took that 1%. We also have to ask, is it a superior vehicle? And we actually see in the rule a couple factors to look at. Let's look at our first one. The class member's interest in individually controlling the prosecution or defense of a separate action. Does that weigh in favor of being together or different? What do you think? What about that first one? The class member's interest in individually controlling the prosecution or defense of a separate action. Yeah, why would that factor in favor of yes, a class action is superior here?
I guess to prevent.
Okay, well, the class action will do that because we all bind together. What we're looking at here is that better? Is that a better result in this case? What we're concerned about is when you take away the power to individually sue, those class members are not going to be here. They're not going to be consulting on the case. You know, they get notice just like you do in the mail from somebody who's filed a class action that you fit within, and you'll get kind of pretty much whatever they come up with. And the arguments they make are the arguments you're going to kind of have to stick with. All right, so what we're asking is it a better use of resources for these class members
to be together as a class, be bound by what happens, or is this something where they're really going to want to individually control this because it matters differently to them in a different way?
You know, so what we're looking at is how common are they really even with their interests and how they're going to pursue the litigation. Do you think the GM dealers have those kind of similar interests in controlling this in a similar way? Yeah, because they all kind of used it relatively in the same way. GM says, no, they didn't. Some put it to these kinds of ads, some put it to those kinds of ads. The court says, sure, but they all think you shouldn't have it. So the way they litigate against GM is going to be the same, even though they might choose to use that 1% in a different way in different dealerships. All right?
But as to you, GM, they all agree it's not yours. All right. So what about the second one? The extent and nature of any litigation concerning the controversy already begun by or against members of the class. What are we looking for in this one? Anybody, what's our issue here? We're looking at the superiority of a class action, and we're considering whether or not the extent and nature of any litigation concerning the controversy has already begun by or against members of the class. Yeah.
Have any of the members already sued?
Okay, have already sued or are currently suing, and why are we concerned about that? Okay, so it might be something that unless they can join the class later on, we're going to have otherwise inconsistent suits going on at the same time. Yeah?
Well, and couldn't that be prejudicial if one of those cases comes out before this case comes out?
No, because it's not going to be binding on the people in the suit because they weren't parties to it.
Okay.
Do you want a lawsuit that's very similar to yours to come out and find a conclusion that, hey, people with similar interests lost? No. But it's not going to really affect you in the sense that they can't bring that into your case. Right. So realize that happens a lot where actually you have people suing in their own venues because people have different motivations of which court they choose and which lawyer they choose, and they don't always want to be together.
Is injunctive relief also not binding if you're not a party to the suit?
All right, so if you're not a party to the suit, you cannot yourself be bound by it, but the defendant is going to have to change their action, which is often why sometimes defendants will certify a class of plaintiffs if they think there's going to be an injunctive relief so that they don't have inconsistent obligations. It's okay to continue dumping. No, it's not. Yeah?
Can we go back to predominance? And what's an example of a common question law or fact that wouldn't predominate? Like when the individual claims, is it kind of like what you were saying, like if somebody wants to go to a federal court or use a different attorney?
No, that's not about, like, the process and why we want a class action versus other people's a process. It's this consideration, superiority. Predominance is about the questions of law or fact at issue in your case. And so it would be a situation where, as to the class, we might have acted differently. And Walmart has that kind of potential in it because not everybody's the same person. Some people are baggers. Some people are part-time summer people who came in, like, while they were at college. Other people made a career at Walmart. They don't all necessarily have the same kind of claim against Walmart because they can't really all claim the same kind of discrimination. Some of them are managers themselves. Some of them are just the workers, okay? So they have a potentially different issues. This kind of an action's not. That's why it fits so well. So as far as Hubler goes, it's an easy fit. All right. So we look for any other litigation concerning the controversy, and here we see none, so that favors class action. Will other litigation necessarily defeat your class action? No. But it might suggest, actually, if everyone wants to sue separately, that the first one's not true, that there is a lot of interest in controlling your own lawsuit. They kind of work all together. All right, third, desirability or undesirability of concentrating the litigation in a particular form. What we're looking at here is, would someone really want to choose to go elsewhere? Okay, why does this one in our case in Hubler make sense to make as a class action? Where did they choose to sue? Federal court where? Which state? Indiana, because they're all from Indiana. All right, so in general, the forum itself seems to be desirable if we're going to concentrate this litigation. All the dealers, while some of them might be in different parts of Indiana, it's not so far away that it would be overburdensome to those individuals. Sometimes, like if we were all in a train accident, we might be coming from all over, right? Just riding on the train. And so we might want to sue in our own jurisdiction because we're injured and healing there and don't want to have to travel across the country to be part of this action, okay? So multiple states, not necessarily defeating a class action, but clearly here this is a good example of an easier fit. It makes the class action more superior. Last one, and this is the most important one, any difficulties in managing the class, and this is the court itself saying, look, I don't want to certify this class. Okay? So anything that's super cumbersome, what are you looking at? Well, basically what you're looking for, is there anything that's going to take away from the ease of management? So is there a lot of discovery that's going to be different amongst the parties, or are we really going to have likely unified discovery? How many class members am I talking that I have to have? When you're talking the Walmart case, when they keep making the numbers go higher and higher and higher, it seems like, gosh, this is going to be too big even for a class action. Can we really do this? Is there going to be inconsistent application of law? Like, do we have members from all over the country that are going to say the state's law in their home state is what actually should be applied? Because what you don't want to have is, I need to apply the law of the states of Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, Illinois, Michigan to resolve this dispute, and they all have different standards, which are not consistent. Because how do you tell the jury, well, for these people, the standard is one of reasonable care. For these people, it's strict liability. And for these people, you just don't. That makes it too much. So you might, in that situation, bring back to your question before, subclass and resolve it in separate strata. Or you might just say, too much to deal with, no class action. Okay. All right, so here, they said it doesn't seem to have any of those issues. There's one state's law that is basically going to apply to the contract laws of the state of Indiana. And it doesn't seem too difficult. There's only 258 members in the class. They're very similarly aligned as far as their issue with respect to GM. And so it gets certified as a damages class. Okay? They sought injunctive. They got certified as a damages class. So in sum, what you'd want to do is make sure you go back through those issues of class prerequisites and then identify which type of class you fit in and run the pieces of that class. Each one has its own standard, its own test. Okay? All right. So why do we care in the end which type of class you're certified as? Well, this kind of brings us up to our notice issues that we have. The first is for damages class, you actually have a specific kind of notice under 23C2B. So turn to that with me. C2B sets out only for B3 classes, which is damages classes, a heightened form of notice. Here you get, the rule tells us, the best notice that is practicable under the circumstances. That's the operative language there. Best notice that's practicable under the circumstances. So here are the kinds of forms of notice you typically get. You can get constructive notice, which is often in publication. Like we put a big notice in a newspaper, we're filing a lawsuit against this company. If you think you have any claims, you might be bound by it. Better forms of service are personal service of process. There's also kind of the hybrid, which is mail. And typically that's the one that's feasible, that's best practicable, that you get as a class lawsuit of this kind. That's why you often get these things in the mail. Postcards, letters, whatnot, saying you're part of this class. Okay, when you think about it, mail, it's costly. It's very costly, especially with lots of numbers of your class. It's less costly than personally serving in hand every single person who's a member of the class, but it is still very expensive. All right. The other aspects of notice we'll get to mandatory class. The other thing in damages is an opt-out provision, and that's codified in two sections of the rule, in 23C2B 5 and 6. They tell us, if you look at the language in 5, it says the court will exclude from the class any member who requests exclusion. That's kind of commonly referred to our colloquial as opting out, because older incantations of the rule kind of discussed it that way. But it's anyone who chooses to exclude may be excluded, meaning the notice has to say, if you choose to not be a member of the suit, this is what you do. Does that mean if you don't do it then that you're stuck with whatever they get you? No. You see, in settlements, you get another chance to exclude yourself from the settlement. But if they have a binding judgment, you're generally stuck. So you have to exercise your rights to opt out of the suit because you'd like to sue individually. That's basically what you're doing. All right, for mandatory classes, which is the first two we talked about, the limited funds, the prejudice kind of the injunctive relief, they also have notification. It's under C2A, but it's much less described. It just says the court may direct appropriate notice to the class. Because they're so similarly aligned, we're less worried that they don't know the lawsuit's going on. I mean, think about it. Someone sues your bank. Someone sues your cell phone provider. How likely are you to know
that they've been overcharging you and that there's a lawsuit going on which might bind you about it. And like, someone sues the neighborhood company that's dumping in the neighborhood, you're likely to know about it more. So the court kind of fashions the notice based upon the parties and how they're aligned. It can be the same level of notice as damages, but it's just not such a high standard, the best practicable, which is what's required for damages. The second part, opting out. Well, one thing I'll tell you, we don't call them mandatory classes for no reason. They're mandatory. It means there is no opt-out provision. You cannot opt out. You're going to be bound by it. Why do you think that's so? Why do you think you're going to be bound by it? Assignments will apply today. Why do you think you can't opt out of a mandatory class? Let's think about what they were. The limited fund class. The injunctive relief. Prejudice to people like GM. We're going to have inconsistent obligations unless we have the joinder of claims potentially against them. Why would we not want someone to opt out of that? Yeah?
A lot of the reasons were for injunctive relief, they're all the same way, getting them to stop. You can't, and they're just being like, all right, they got you to stop, and then I'm not damages, and you cannot.
Well, you can still sue potentially, or if you're bound by it, you might have had damages rolled into your injunctive, or if you're really seeking damages, you'd be a damages class. But as far as the injunctive relief, let's think about it as to like the person who's being told stop dumping. What do they really want out of that decision? Do they really want like one suit and then another suit and then another suit?
No. They already resolved the issue.
Well, yeah, and they need to know whether or not their behavior is going to be condoned or not. I mean, they might be enjoined as against this person, but it would make no sense if as to that property owner I could still be dumping on their land, arguably. I think another one is if you think about it from the perspective of like limited fund classes, right? If we're all saying we need to join together because there's a set amount of assets, and if we sue separately, we're likely to go over the cap, can you understand why we wouldn't want some people to still go out and sue on their own? What if someone goes around the class suit and sues on their own on a limited fund? They're a single suit, so not going to move as slowly as class action. Yeah?
Funds with class action.
They'll be more limited than they already are, because potentially that person could end run the class action, race through it, settle, and get a chunk out. It's just almost, if we don't mandate it, it drives that, right? Go and do it, get around it, because a class lawsuit might guide you to a more equitable distribution. And you're like, equity? Not me. I'd rather have everything I've ever lost recouped, and then some. So I'm going to go quickly and settle. Well, if we allow people to do that, it defeats the whole idea of the class action being the equitable way in which we distributed that limited source of funds. We're all injured. There's not enough money out here, people. Let's just figure out the best, most equitable way to distribute it based on maybe need or based on maybe injury. Okay? Yes?
Can you talk a little bit more about the certification notice for this class? It's not required.
No, it is. It's just directed on the rule that the court decides what's appropriate as opposed to being mandated that it's the best form practicable. So the best form practicable suggests that you can't take something that's slightly less of what would the person who's seeking notice would have wanted. So instead of like doing a public, instead of doing like a mailer to you, we're likely to do publication, like in the newspaper in the local area. Yes.
So, going along with that, a television advertisement at 3 a.m. asking if I've ever been injured by a bandia, that does qualify as any kind of notice, but if it's in publication, I would think that if you publicize it. Well, the key is for 2B, it says individual notice. Clearly, that's not individual notice.
Yeah, unless they can't identify you.
All right.
All right. So, in a situation where you might have been someone who don't have a way to get records of what you've taken, then that's the best form practicable. Because a lot of your records are sealed. I mean, you're with doctors all over the country. And that is a form of appropriate notice. It's called publication. It's just publication doesn't have to be in print. It can't be televised. It can be by email. Generally, you pick something that's more likely that these consumers would likely to have. So if something we had was like an email prescriptions or whatever we're purchasing, then if we chose email as a way of publication, assuming our state permits that kind of notice, it would be more appropriate. Notice requirements are also limited by the state. Some of them don't recognize certain forms. It's not consistent across the states. So some allow more technological ones, some don't. Some allow TV, some don't.
And a lot of the advertisements you see are more for people trying to get members to join. Like, they're trying to solicit for, have you ever been injured? And they're really trying to solicit for people.
With mandatory classes, if you're not notified, you still can file your own individual lawsuit, or no?
Mm-mm. No. The idea is the notice was given, and assuming that they follow what the courts found, unless you can challenge that it was an unconstitutional amount of notice, you're bound by it. The standard under the Constitution is not actual receipt of notice. You'll learn this when you get to jurisdiction. We talk more about notice as a constitutional concept. But you don't get to say, I just didn't get it. And the reason being, if that was the standard, what would you likely do? This mailing looks official. You know, so we have to make sure that there's a set type of notice. It's not whether you actually get it. So a lot of times you're going to be part of class lawsuits that will bind you that you might not know about. That's some of the dangers of larger suits like this, and why people don't like class actions a lot. Yeah?
The Walmart case with almost 2 million...
Hang on to Walmart! We're going to get there in 2 seconds! Let me finish this, and we'll get to Walmart, okay? I promise, it's coming! Just let me finish this up, and then we'll talk about Walmart, because I want to use it as a total review. And since some people might have more knowledge of it than others, I'd rather wait. Okay. All right. So, since that's the last of the gist of it stuff, let's get to settlement. And I have a Walmart slide, and then I swear, look, that's the Walmart slide. It's coming. All right, so requirements of settlements. This kind of goes hand-in-hand with our notice and our opt-out. It's the last bit of process with respect to class actions. That we have, the court must approve the settlement. And this is for all types of classes, these requirements. The court must send out notice of the settlement. We're going to see an additional aspect to notice of settlement when you get a damages suit. But all suits get some form of notice ordered by the court of settlement. The court must actually hold a hearing to determine if the settlement is fair, reasonable, and adequate, assuming that this will bind the class members. If somehow the settlement only settles out the parties and we don't hold a hearing, what we're trying to do is make sure that the parties are still continually adequately represented who aren't there. And if the court's not involved, we're sometimes concerned that they're not. All right, so if it's going to bind the members, we hold a hearing. And it's about fairness, adequacy, and reasonableness of your settlement. What kinds don't we like? Coupons. Don't like coupons. For the federal government's one of the biggest things that they've had an issue with is that there'd be lots of claims all cobbled together and everyone just gets like $10 off the next time the company does this to you. All right. This applies to all classes, but there's an additional requirement for damages classes. That's an E4, which says you get a new opportunity to opt out. And they give you grounds for refusal of the settlement. Now, one of your classmates gave me an example of one that they got of this that was online. They also had a paper copy of, and if it comes up, I'll show you what it looks like. Ask me later. All right. No. Not right now, later. I know. Hold on 1 second. Okay, here we go. There you go. So if you paid overdraft fees to National City, then this is what might happen. And they say, here's important dates off to the left. Decline to request exclusion from the settlement or decide to do that. The deadline to object to the settlement. And they basically tell you what you get. And so that's the aspect of the notice of settlement. They tell you, if you didn't already opt out, this is what you're going to get. You can decide to opt out now. That's only for damages because the others are mandatory classes. But they all get some form of notice. All right. All right. So that'll be in there if you want to take a look at what they
first? The first one.
Must, must approve the settlement. All right. Any other questions on the settlement process? Okay, so if you look at it, if you were to put like a summary kind of block about what you're looking at for the process here, there is a lot of court oversight. That's what the basic aspect of 23E is. Class actions have mandated by the rules oversight by the court. In a normal lawsuit, there isn't oversight of your settlement. You could settle your case for magic beans and the court does not care. But you cannot do that in a class action. Why? Because there's other people who are going to be bound by this lawsuit who actually weren't there to litigate their own claims. And so we really make sure that it's fair. We do that for all of our class actions. But we're most skeptical about damages class actions because they tend to drive the like nefarious kind of litigation where people bring things together to go up against the corporation and they don't have as much similarly aligned interests. The injunctive kind of ones Are we really worried that the first neighbor that's suing is the party is going to be arguing something wildly different than the other people and going to settle to a less than satisfactory injunctive relief? Probably not, because they don't want their land to continue to get polluted. So we have less oversight of those. All right, here's our last bit. Here's just a general note for you. 23C3 tells you the court in a class action judgment must describe the class which is to be bound, meaning you have to tell us what the definition was so we know who's actually going to be bound by it, and you tell us what type of class it was. And for those damages kinds of lawsuits, you have to say who got notice and who is still bound. In other words, who did not opt out. So the actual final judgment indicates all of that, so you know whether or not this is going to bind you. And the court has the power to divide up the class action as to particular issues and resolve only those, or divide them into subclasses based upon how similarly aligned the members are. So subclasses, never hired because of race or gender. Another subclass might be failed to promote. We have more interests in common between failing to promote and failing to get hired, because there might be a different motivation in that group. So those might be separate subclasses. Separate division of issues is really about, well, we found a lot of commonality on the question of did you do bad conduct, but not a lot of commonality on damages, because some of you lost a career and lots of money. Other of you only had a little bit. You just didn't get your summer job at Walmart when you were in college. Not the same as someone who spent their whole career there and really was capped because of gender or race. Right, so we might just say it's all just about the question of did they have a discriminatory policy as opposed to what you actually get. All right, so since everyone's been itching to get there, I'll just give you the background, and we'll start with this in our next class. Okay, Dukes versus Walmart is obviously about the star we all know and love, Walmart. They allege that women who were employed there were paid less than men in comparable positions despite having higher performance ratings and greater superiority. So in other words, the person who was there less, who didn't do as good a job as you, got promoted over you. And they say it's solely because it was a guy, not a girl. All right, second, they received fewer and waited longer for promotions to in-store management positions than men. So that's the crux of what they're arguing. Now, they're not arguing Walmart in a certain state or Walmart even in a region. They're arguing Walmart in the entire country. And so it's going to be difficult to show that you really do have a common understanding here. Here's the factual aspects of it. It's a nationwide class of women who are subjected to allegedly discriminatory pay and promotion policies, although many of those key decisions are made at the store level. They're employed in a range of positions, part-time, entry-level, hourly employees to salaried managers. So we have a wide range of kinds of employees. They seek injunctive and declaratory relief, back pay, punitive damages, but not traditional compensatory damages, and have an average loss of just over $1,000. In our next class, I'll tell you a little bit about who the reps are, because they have very different kinds of backgrounds. But in general, this is what the class was labeled as. All women, this is the definition, all women employed at Walmart domestic retail stores, so just the national chain, at any time since December 26, 1998, who've been or may be subjected to Walmart's challenge pay and management track promotions, policies, and practices. A lot of people. A lot of people. All right, so I'm going to ask you in our first class to go through the prerequisites for class actions, thinking about this class, and ask you to weigh in which ones you think are going to be the tough ones, and then talk about the type of class. So we'll use this in our next class. Continue on to voluntary dismissal, because it's actually very short material. I did that intentionally, assuming class actions always goes over a little bit. So we'll start there next class, too.